This is a tape recording made by Lieutenant Whittaker of the flight which Eddie Rickenbacker was on, and they were lost at sea for 21 days. It was made in Minneapolis and is being re-recorded today, August 7th, 1962.
You are. I'm very glad to be here this afternoon. We're not glad to be anywhere this afternoon, especially off the Pacific. And I just got through being in Minneapolis on a life raft. Oh, just about. I did get there on a cutter today. Once I was born there, then I had a relapse. And that doesn't help much. I've had another trouble. I don't know if you folks can bother with that or not, but I have insomnia. I keep waking up every 15 or 16 hours. I can't sleep straight through anymore. You ever have that? I may fall asleep up here tonight if I have to.
He listened to
was for quite a while. But finally, he got a little upset, and he said, "Now look, fellas, I just work here." Of course, he said that you're afraid to fly the airplane, say so. And we got a crew to this. And we said, "No, we're not afraid." And I've wished ever since that we told him the truth. And we were afraid. And he reminded us that our orders were to shift our gear and get that plane in the air immediately, so we had no alternative. So the only thing we had time to do was to check our fuel and oil, shift our passengers and baggage, start up our engines, and get going. For 15 hours and 10 minutes after our takeoff, we came in for our landing. And we missed Canton Island, our first gas stop, completely through the failure and error of instruments. Now, ordinarily in an ocean flight, we work up to within about an hour and a half of destination with our navigators. Then, as a double check, we turn on our radio compass. Well, a needle of that compass would take a plane over a station broadcasting within 20 feet, plus or minus. They're very accurate. But when we turned ours on that morning, we found it jammed. Now, we couldn't move a dial in any direction, and we worked on that set for about 3 hours. We never got it to work. Then our magnetic compass, and that was the error part. And of course, all magnetic compasses do have an error. They are accompanied by a correction card that lists the various errors in a different direction. Well, our card told us that we had an error of 4 degrees. Now, our navigator had to have that information before he could plan a flight or give a pilot direction to fly. And our navigator used that card, which was proper, was there for that purpose. That was also our mistake. Of course, I only found that out about 3 years ago. I was talking one night back in New York State at a national dinner club. I got up to speaker's table that evening, and next to my place there was a captain. He was a navigator in uniform on recruiting duty. And the minute I sat down, this fellow turned to me and he said, "Say, do you remember that plane you fellows went down in?" Well, I said, "Slightly." Well, he said, "Did you know when you took that plane that your compass was out 18 degrees? Did they tell you?" Well, I said, "No, the correction card said 4. Oh, he says, "That was an old card." He said their crew had that plane on patrol 2 days before we left with it. They got lost out of Honolulu on that patrol. They got back purely by accident. He told me that he had swung that compass twice, and it was out 18 degrees. So actually, we left Honolulu with 14 degrees of error, of which we knew nothing. And that meant that we could not have come within 350 miles of that island at any time. We were lost the minute our wheels came off the runway. And this fellow turned to me again. He said, "By the way, did you ever get that radio compass to work?" I said, "No, we didn't." Well, he says, "We didn't either." So I knew he had the right airplane anyway. But he told me their crew had grounded that plane. They put it on a Red Cross for a complete instrument overhaul. Now, that Red Cross meant that plane was not to be flown until the engineering officer signed off that the work had been completed. But for some reason, that plane had never been touched when we were ordered into it, and we were never even given the courtesy of an explanation of why we had to take that plane. But there were no doubts in our minds of what we had it next morning when we missed heaven. Then we ran about 30 minutes past our estimated time of arrival before we had a radio operator break radio silence. He picked up the island in code on another set. Of course, we could hear them on that set, but we couldn't locate them. The set was non-directional. But we asked them for lost plane procedure. Now, ordinarily, that procedure will locate and bring in a plane very quickly. But this time, Canton Island told us they didn't have the necessary equipment to give us the information we required. And it was a little bit early in the war then for everything to be in the Pacific that should have been. And that stuff got there about 2 weeks after we went down. Of course, we heard of it later, but it didn't do us much good at the time. But over the next 5.5 hours, we exhausted every possibility of the island helping us, or are we helping ourselves. And about an hour before before we ever start. Now, the only thing we had was what was left of the lunch that we'd taken in Honolulu. Of course, that was only the last that threw the night flight. And of that, we only had 3 sandwiches left. And they were some of those delicious Spam sandwiches you've heard of. Well, they're really not so bad if you haven't had anything else to eat for about 3 weeks. We had a few apples and oranges, possibly a quart of water and a cup of cold coffee. I detailed one of the men to get that when we abandoned ship. I went back to the cockpit, secured myself with Captain Terry. Terry was our commanding officer and pilot. I was his co-pilot. We put Air Force cushions over our stomachs, fastened a safety belt over that, and then we moved the seats back as far as they'd go. And at 5,000 feet, we killed 2 engines, started down the other 2 with about 10 minutes gas. We got down to about 2 feet off of the water. The Bill had the plane almost stalled. The tail was low. He was feeling for the water. I pulled the main line switch to kill every electrical connection aboard, cut the 2 remaining engines. Bill hooked the tail into the water, and we went on. And that was the best landing I've ever seen in an airplane, and I've been flying for 24 years. But none of us had ever been through a water landing before. But we've never seen one. And that's the kind of a landing, unfortunately, you don't get to practice. I'm not in a land plane. You either make it or you die. And sometimes you do both. But I know if I was ever going into a 10-foot sea with a B-17 again, well, I'd want Bill Terry's judgment and hands in that plane when we landed. But we contacted the water at a speed between 95 and 100 miles an hour. We stopped completely in less than 40 feet. Now, the boil, our wake and back of the fuselage, was no longer, and that's when we got out. And, of course, that built up tremendous pressure. It's hard to describe, but, well, you might try it in your car someday. Yeah, that'll give you a rough idea. A very rough. But get your car up to 100 miles an hour. If it was a Pontiac, you better go downhill. Well, mine will only do 95. Of course, I just got a little old fix. But get up to 100, stop at 40 feet, and then see where you stop. It'll be somewhere about 5 miles down the Pearl. That cushion I had on my stomach, well, it seemed to be trying to push my backbone through the skin of my back. There was a bitter vinegar taste in my mouth. My eyes wound up like a big clock spring. Yeah, they just seemed to make a big circle like that. Well, that was the right one. The left one went the other direction. Well, they did. They got up to the top and seemed to quiver. Then they unwound. At the time they got unwound, I could almost see again. For as soon as any of us could move, we got to the roof course in our life raft compartment, cleared the 2 rafts that were there, and we had a small raft back into Bombay. Now, the Army laughingly called that thing a 2-man raft. And it's big enough for 2 men if they're about 7 years old. And we were older than that. But we got the raft clear through a top hatch. We abandoned ship in about 50 seconds with the 3 rafts and 8 men. We got about 100 feet away, tying the raft together at intervals. I turned to the man I had detailed to get what little we had and asked him if he'd gotten it clear all right. He looked around rather startled. He says, "Gee, Lieutenant, I forgot." And our main object at that time was to get away from that plane alive. So we were all in a big hurry. We all forgot something. I don't think any of us blamed him for forgetting. But I left us sitting there watching a plane go down with 4 oranges as our total possession. Captain Cherry and Lieutenant DeAnst was our navigators, and put those in their pockets before we left the plane. And calling those things oranges, I did so only through courtesy. So they were the most anemic, weak-kneed specimens I've ever seen. Of course, I'm from California. And for that reason, I'd like to say those things might have been Florida oranges. No, all over them. Us California fans, so I guess we're stuck with them. Or at least we were stuck with them out there. We write them those things one a day for 4 days. We didn't eat the peeling. We thought the acid would harm us more than it would help us. And when you cut a, well, an orange that small into 8 parts, well, each of us got just enough to make us wish we had a slice of orange. I know it didn't do us any good. It was too small. Of course, that was the only thing we had. We didn't argue with it. And after the fourth morning, there's nothing to argue with anyway. It was gone. And I remember the afternoon of that day more clearly for another reason. For we started a gruesome conversation. See, on the third day, Johnny DeAngelis had found 4 fish hooks in his pocket. Or rather, they were in his bill hole. Or had they been loose in his pocket, he would have found them beef the third day. And we had line on the raft. We could see fish in the water, and we tried to snag them. You know, just yank a bare hook up by them. Well, that's as close as we can to them. We tried baiting a hook with orange peel. Well, they didn't seem to like that. Ain't better than we did. They wouldn't bite it. And we tried catching them by hand. Now, Rick had a hold of 2. He couldn't hold on. Once, the one about that long started by our raft. He was close in, about 2 inches underwater, and just fooling along in no hurry at all until I leaned over and grabbed him. And I got both hands just in front of his tail. Well, he got in a hurry then. And I tried to pull him in over the side of the raft. Well, I got his tail about 1.5 feet out of the water. I just about ready to lean over and take a good bite out of him. And the tighter I squeezed, the slicker he got. Finally, he just squeaked out and was gone. And so I licked my hands and called it a day. Well, the other fellas wanted to lick too, but they were my hands. It wasn't any meat on them, but it sure did taste good. But we haven't caught any fish. So that fourth afternoon, we started talking about who we were going to cut on first to use for bait. Yeah, it seems a little strange back here now that we weren't kidding. Because we knew we could catch fish if we had bait and we were going to have something. Of course, only 2 knives in our party. Well, one of them happened to be in our raft. Yeah, I happened to have it. And I know in the next 10 minutes someone would have lost an ear. Well, there were 2 nice ones sitting just in front of me, and they weren't military. But that bird came and landed on Rick's head. Yeah, just like that. And I've been asked a number of times if that really happened. It did. Of course, it didn't happen exactly as it was shown in Life magazine. Perhaps some of you recall that artist's guess of the raft with Rick in it and the bird on his head. It was a nice picture. So I always wanted to meet the artist to do that. For that fellow has the most vivid imagination. Why, had we caught that big turkey that he drew sitting on Rick, we would have eaten for a month. Yeah, I've often wished he had to eat what we actually caught. It was a little, scrawny, beaten-up old sea swallow. I was less than half the size of a seagull. He circled around twice. He was just about the tiredest bird I've ever seen. He came floating in and landed on Rick's head as though it were a fence post, figuratively speaking. We held our breath and Rick started up after him, but very carefully. He didn't want that bird to think he had designs on him. He sneaked up and scratched his chin, his cheek, and his ear. He was about the itchiest fellow I've ever seen. He got up under his hat brim. He was afraid to go farther, so we sat down, and Rick made a grab. He caught him with one leg, pulled him down the raft, and de-headed him and disrobed him, or took his feathers off, and we cut him up for bait. Now, I have read in 2 places other than my own writing that we ate that bird, but if that was the same trip I was on, we didn't. Well, there was nothing on him to eat. He was just bone and muscle. I tried to eat one leg and got exactly nowhere. But using that bird for bait, we caught 2 fish about 8 inches long. And that included the tails. With that, we caught the second fish. The shark had taken all of our hooks. Now, when a shark hit a hook, we had the end of the line. He had the hook. We could only do that four times. But there are four sharks in the Pacific that I hope have indigestion to the fourth and fifth generation. So we cut those two lonesome little fish up. We had about a square inch of food each. Now, that isn't a great deal as food goes, especially raw fish, but it was something. And we had reached a place where we needed something very badly. For our morale was gone, what little we started with, and I never knew before that that could be too important. Well, at least I didn't think a person might die from lack of morale, but I changed my mind. So I think some of us would have died eating it a sixth day beyond a doubt. If we'd had Ripley's column with us, I read in California later. Of course, that little thing would have made a difference then to some of us. For in that column, Mr. Ripley said that no man had ever lived over 6 days without water. And I suppose it was only through our own ignorance that we lived 8 days. We didn't know any better. Well, I wrote to Ripley and apologized for doing that to him. Well, he didn't answer. And we caught our first drop of water of any kind the evening of the 8th day when it rained on us. Of course, we were on the equator. It does get a little warm down there. We've been encrusted with salt. That doesn't help thirst much. And when that rain hit us, we knew nothing whatever about catching it or saving it. Of course, the second rain, we cut the seats out of the raft and used as rain catchers. The first, we just held clothing out in our arms so it became saturated. We had to wring the salt out of that twice. Then we bring the water into our mouth and blow it into a tube of our May West life preserver to save it. We didn't at that time drink any of the water caught in the clothing. And what we drank then, we licked from our skins as it rained on us. And we got about a small glass of water each that way. Of course, I don't think that got to our stomach. Now, we were dehydrated to such an extent it was absorbed before it got there. And we only saved enough to last us 2 days. It rained hard, but not very long. And I say last us, we had 1 inch in the bottom of a flare shell twice a day. Of course, that wasn't quite enough to pound her on, but it did help to carry us over. But the evening of the 10th day saw our last ration. And then we had a little water left. It was about a mouthful. It wasn't enough to go around our crew again. So we elected to save that back for our first engineer. He was a 19-year-old sergeant from Pennsylvania by the name of Alex Kazmarczyk. And he was a Polish boy that had been a member of a B-25 combat crew. But his plane came up from the South Pacific for an overhaul. It had gone back to New Guinea. And they left Alec in Honolulu with yellow jaundice. Yeah, he'd been in the hospital 48 days. He'd only been out of bed 17. It hadn't been enough to build his strength back to where it had to be for what we were looking at. So he started to get sick the 4th or 5th day. And every day after that, he got worse. What we tried to do, we could for him, but there isn't much you can do in a rock. By the evening of the 10th, he was getting pretty bad. And we thought by giving him that little extra water, he'd be better next morning. But the next morning, he was much worse. Now, he started to get delirious the first part of that day. And he stayed that way most of the time for the next 2 days until he died. And during the time, Alec was delirious. Well, it seemed to me that most of his time was spent in begging us for water. And in praying to us for water. He prayed to us as though we were God. He cried to us. And he died not understanding why we wouldn't give him anything. But he knew we had plenty in the other raft. So we pulled a raft together and tried to show him, but you couldn't show him. No, you couldn't convince him. He knew we had it. Then he thought we were mad at him. Yeah, he told us that he was a good boy and wouldn't harm us to please give him something. Well, he was a good kid. He was much the youngest of any of our party. And half 13th day, Johnny Bartek, our second engineer, called to us from a small raft that Alec had died. And we pulled a raft together to see that he had left it. Then we told Bartek to see he didn't fall out of the raft till daylight, and we buried him. With daylight, we came together and had service. Well, I don't suppose you'd even call it service back here, but we did the best we could with what we had to do with. We said the Lord's Prayer, and perhaps that wasn't too appropriate, but most of the fellas seemed to know it. So I heard one man say he'd forgotten it. And I wish very much, and more for Alex's sake than my own, that I could have said that too. But I didn't know it in the first place. I couldn't have forgotten it. See, I was almost 41 then, but I had never been inside a church or a Sunday school in my life for any reason whatever. Now, I've never run into anything much bigger than I was. Well, I thought religion was for children or people too weak to help themselves. Now, I was too big. I didn't need it. So I stumbled along and beckoned the others to his finish. Then we put him in the water and watched him float away. Of course, we knew he didn't float very long. So we had sharks with us from the time we hit the water until we got out. They ran from a foot and a half to around 12 foot in length. But there was no time, night or day, before we could see four or five of them. Either their fins cutting through the water away from the raft. They used to swim right alongside. Now they'd been so close, I reached out and patted them with my hand as they went by. For the small ones, I used to pat with the end of an oar. Well, the big ones, I was afraid to. Now, I wouldn't want to get one of those things mad at me anywhere that they're mean. And they used to have a bad habit of rolling underneath the raft. Now, the bottom of those rafts, well, they're very pliable. You sit at the bottom, it's much the same as sitting in a hammock. Yet would leave quite a depression underneath. Was God used to rope? And I suppose he was scratching his butt. But in doing that, he'd lose speed. He'd start to swim away from the raft. He'd bring his tail way down. Then right up underneath the raft. Well, I never did figure out how they could be so accurate. Now, I don't remember once them missing all of us. And an 8-foot shark had raised you about 4 or 5 inches. Well, it'd be about the same as someone patting you with a 1x12. Now, that can get monotonous. Of course, nothing we could do about it is sit there and take it. So I did hear a few pointed remarks here and there. But they didn't care what we said about them. They kept right on going. And they had one good feature in doing that. And they used to scrape sea life from their hides. Now that little animal, about as big as my thumb, he has two fingers like a crab. Well, as soon as we caught on to that, every time we got walloped, we put our head over the side. If we saw one of those things crawling up the bottom, we'd pull our head back if he saw us, he'd drop off. And we'd stalk him till he hit the water line. As soon as he hit the water line, we had him, so open our mouth and chew him up. Oh, they had a very delicate flavor. Well, I meant from where we were sitting then. I don't think I'd like one now. Of course, today, if you happen to have some home in your deep freeze, well, you eat them. But we caught 3 of those, and I made a little mistake on the first one I caught. Yeah, I gave him first bite. They came around the raft only the one time. We managed to scoop them 3 to those. First we caught them, we just threw them in and chewed them up too. Or anyway, the other fellas did. Oh, I did too. you, but I had a different method. And though it's rather painful to me, I think I better take time to go through that method for the benefit of any of you that may someday be in my condition. And I think you all will be someday. Just stick around, be patient. But if you ever get caught on a raft in that condition, well, you at least know how to eat those things, and I'm sure you'll enjoy them a lot more. I hope. But about 2 months before I left the States on this particular trip, the Army presented me with these China clippers I am whistling through up here. Well, some people call them freewheeling crockery. Well, I call them a lot of things. But when you lose weight, they don't fit anymore. Now, they not only don't fit, they fall out. I used to wear mine in my shirt pocket. Now, when I catch one of those things, I'd get him one hand, the bottom of the raft, and sit on it so he couldn't jump overboard. With the other hand, I'd get the clippers out, put them in. Then I'd throw the fish in with the clippers, and they'd chase him around. We got a good bite on him. As soon as they caught up with him, I got a good hold, and I lowered the boom. Now, that first bite, you're going to find just a little bit squishy. Of course, after that, he'll lie still. You can chew him up good. But those three little minnows, with one exception, completed our entire menu for 21 days. And perhaps that made a difference in the way we looked at those things. I think it made the same difference to any of you. But I haven't mentioned very much food, but that was it. And with that exception, you could put what each of us had in a teacup. It wouldn't have been much over half full, so we didn't have too much to eat for 3 weeks. And that exception took the form of two other fish about 7 to 8 inches long. And I made an exception of it because it happened one evening in a way. Well, to me at the time, it should have been a great deal of coincidence. It may appear so to some of you, it didn't to me very long. But it happened that evening after I heard Bill Cherry offer a prayer. Now, I have heard many prayers in the Pacific, especially that early in the war, when it looked to a lot of those out there as though we might lose. Now, I've heard big men pray and those who thought they were big. I've heard little men in airplanes, on ships, islands, and hospitals, and of course on the raft. But on the raft, there was a little difference. But on there, I don't recall ever hearing a thee or a thou. Now, those men talked to God as they would to some friend or neighbor, not to anyone to be afraid of. They spoke in their own manner after what was in their own heart. Now, Bill Cherry is a Texan. He was 27 years old at that time, exactly my size. But Bill had gone through Hart and Simmons University at Abilene on a football scholarship. So Hart and Simmons had a good football team then. Any man that stayed on it 4 years on a scholarship, you could figure was a very tough lad. And Bill is. He's also one of the finest soldiers and men that I've ever known. Of course, I don't know how much Bill has prayed in his life. I don't imagine too much. But I do know the first prayer of my life went from that raft. And it went then only because I was getting afraid. You know, it seems too bad in a country such as ours that a person could get as old as I was, get the position I was in, and have to meet the master as a stranger through fear. But I was always a wise guy. I always knew everything. I always had to do things the hard way. And of course, I was no exception. But in Bill's prayer that evening, he said, "Old master, we're getting awful thirsty and hungry, and we haven't been able to catch anything for ourselves. I guess we'll leave it up to you whether you're going to help us out of this mess or not. But you could get us anything at all. This afternoon or tomorrow at the latest. We sure would appreciate it. Amen." Well, that doesn't sound much like a prayer, as I've heard them back here. In less than 10 minutes, those two fish jumped into our raft. Now, we didn't catch them, they jumped in. And that might have been a coincidence, surely, until you consider the size of those rocks. The interdimensional sides of a large raft were about the same as the outer rim of your bathtub. Now put them down in the middle of the immensity of the Pacific Ocean. At the exact spot, the exact instant, the barracuda were chasing a school of small fish. So they jumped out of the water to get away from the barracuda, and two of them fall in those rafts. So I think you'd have the makings of a very far-fetched coincidence. I know that I had heard a prayer given from a man's heart, and I had seen that prayer answered physically and immediately. And it was my privilege to have seen that four times in the Pacific, the immediate physical answer to prayer. And each time it was under conditions that left no room for doubt as to whether there was something bigger than I was, and if anyone ever needed proof. Well, I think I was that person, and I got it. But there'd be no time here to go through all the happenings or the 21 days that we sat around those rocks. If I did, it would probably bore you as much as it did us. That's all we had to do was sit and wait and hope. And we saw nothing but a possibility picking us up. We'd been at sea for over 18 days. And that could be a stretch of calendar under some conditions. But late in the afternoon of that day, we were, well, just lounging around the raft. We didn't have anything else to do anyway. Jerry had his head down in one of the air chambers. I was on the other side of the raft. Jim Reynolds, our radio operator, is on the other end. It is our heads where our bodies were. Well, three of you get in the bathtub, you see about what I mean. But Bill picked his head up very suddenly. He shook the raft. I thought a shark bit him. I looked around. He had a wild look in his eyes. He said, "I hear an airplane engine." I said, "Again?" See, we'd all heard airplane engines. We all heard too many things. We had all talked to people who weren't there. We had seen people that weren't there. So I looked over Reynolds. I said, "Here we go again. Bill's in. Get him that side." But less than 10 seconds after Bill heard the engine that time, we all heard it. We took that plane up to the west, 12, 15 miles away. To just a speck that headed right for us. Of course, we knew then that our worry had been for nothing. This man had it. All we had to do was figure what to drink when he got to it. I heard many items mentioned in the next few seconds. Well, the seconds took that plane to get about 5 or 6 miles away. When he got there, he changed course to the north. He missed us by about 3 miles, and he didn't see us. Of course, that was a little bit disappointing. Oh, we waved at him. We said, "Yoo-hoo!" Yeah, that's about all we had left. And of course, he hadn't seen it. He couldn't hear it. But that night, none of us even made a pretense of sleeping. Now, we just sat around the raft. Nobody wanted to go out much anyway. The following morning, we picked that plane up coming east. Well, we thought he had a dead center until he got about the same distance away as the other plane. And he also changed course. He missed it by about the same margin, and he didn't see it. That afternoon, that same plane came back from the west. We found later it was the same one. One of our own Navy scout observations. That plane came within about a mile and a half of us. We could make out the men in the cockpit. And they looked very well fed and well watered. And again, they didn't see it. But we didn't know why. I talked to the pilot of that plane later. Navy Lieutenant Fred Woodard from Dubuque, Iowa. He says, "Whip, some of the fellows call me Whip. I'm just half Whip." But he said, "If you fellas been farther away from us, we've probably seen you." Now, that's a fine way to be missed, being too close. But we didn't know that plane was on an offensive patrol looking for a Jap task force supposedly heading south. We didn't know they were watching the horizon and the air more than they were the immediate surface. We didn't know they'd given up the search for us on the 13th day. So we only knew that we could see that plane so clearly, and he hadn't seen us. But I heard men deny God then. If they admitted God, they wanted no part of him. So if he could let three planes go by, one so close and not see it, they weren't going to play. And it may made a very bad night for all of us. Well, if I knew nights could be long, I'd spend a lot of them. I suppose most of you have, too. But I didn't know one night could be an eternity, but I think we all found it out that night. We had two of our men bail out on us about 2:30 that morning. They went over the side, let the chart finish it off fast, because they felt that they had taken enough, and they didn't propose to sit there and take any more. And we couldn't blame them. See, everyone there had taken four times what they thought they could take, and it was only those men's misfortune to have broken ahead of the rest of us. But we all knew we had our turn coming. We weren't kidding ourselves anymore. But even though we couldn't blame them, it took most of the strength we had left to get them back in the raft and change their minds for them. But that night had to wear itself out eventually. At daylight, we took a boat to split up. And I was in hope one of the rafts would be seen before we drifted through that patrol into open sea again. The boat wanted found Johnny DeAngelis alone in the small raft. But Johnny didn't want to go alone. And I don't think Bill Sherry did either. But Bill was in command. He was in much better shape than Johnny. So he told him as an order to get over with me, and he would take that route. But by the middle of the afternoon, we drifted out of sight of the others. That night, well, it wasn't very short either. But at daylight on our 21st day, the first thing we saw to the west was a row of palm trees about 10 miles long. They seemed to be about that far away, 10, 12 miles. And the other raft never sighted that island at all. At first we thought it was a mirage, but it stayed there. So we finally got out the aluminum oars that were packed in the bottom of the raft and started rowing, thinking that we would get in a couple of hours. And I don't know yet what we based that on, for none of us were in what you'd call top condition. I had expected Jim Reynolds to be dead that morning. I thought we were going to have to bury him. He couldn't set up along the evening before. His eyes weren't intact and his head, his face looked like a skull. His mind had started to wander. And popped in the front of the raft that morning, he could barely raise his arms. But somehow, he did that all morning, pouring water down the back of my neck to keep me from blacking out. And what he did it on, I'll never know. At the end, Bush fell me twice for 10-minute intervals on the oars during that morning. And those intervals meant whether we kept going or not. See, we were going west, the north wind was drifting us down across the face of the island. And we stopped rowing for any reason. We'd been twisted around the end, unable to get back, so we had to keep going. And what those two men did, they gave everything they had, no one could do more. But they left us safe, weighing 130 pounds each, their normal weight. They finished out there with less than 85. First I started 186, I went to 133. And losing 53 pounds, I was tough loser. But I finished weighing more than they started with. So naturally, most of the work of the trip was up to me. And we were only grateful any one of us had enough weight to do something with the oars. It didn't matter who. But we didn't get in a couple of hours. At the end of about 5.5 hours, we had been close twice. But we still weren't on. And the first part of that morning was very hot. Well, they all are out there, and every day seems to get worse. And still there was no perspiration. So I put my finger in my mouth and got powder on it. Yeah, there wasn't moisture in my body to moisten my mouth. Of course, I was forced to breathe through it partially. That contributed. But we got about a fourth of the way in. A few small clouds started to form and floating down from the north. They kept increasing about three-fourths of the way. It was almost solid overcast. The wind got a little gusty along through there. But we made pretty good headway, and it was cooler until we got up within about a quarter of a mile of the outer reef of Nootka Patel Island. When we got there, we were hit by a wind squall. It picked the raft up and whirled it back to sea, I'd say, well over 2 miles. Yeah, we all wanted to quit then, so we didn't want to keep going. But it seems as long as you can breathe or think, you keep trying. But as we came back toward the island, the wind got stronger and gustier. It seemed to shift a little west, which put it slightly against us. So we inched our way back to within about 200 yards of that reef. We thought we'd be on in a few minutes if we lasted that long. And about 200 yards offshore, a wind shift came straight out of the west directly across the island. Hit the raft with a strong gust that almost turned us over. It took us on edge and it took us right back to sea over a mile and a half again before it turned loose. And that time we all knew we were not going to make it. Now we hit the bottom of the barrel. There was nothing left and no reason for any of us to try to go on. Now the answer and Reynolds were in the bottom of the raft then. I know that neither of those men had even the will, let alone the strength to have opened his eyes. I know I didn't. I had fallen forward across the oars, knowing that I wouldn't get up again. So I got up for the last time, I knew it. I was done, through, and finished. I didn't have a thing on earth left, except a fire. And perhaps I wasn't too familiar with that. So maybe even then I didn't have too much faith in it. But that was all I had. Then I just told the master the condition we were in. I told him we'd given everything that we had and it wasn't enough. That Jimmy was going to die. That we all would if he didn't see fit to help us. And I asked his help. I came up off of those oars and beached the raft on the island about 2 hours later. Against a head wind. Knowing that I held those oars in my hands. But also knowing that there's no strength of mine went through my body at any time in pulling those oars. I could feel a shaft bending in my hand, but there wasn't physical strength in that entire raft to have been a pin. We had been out too long. We didn't have it. The raft surged ahead in the water. The previous hours it had moved very slowly. And I didn't protest then, but do I here today to be able to tell you exactly where that power came from, or precisely what it was. And I do know it was a whole lot bigger than I am, bigger than all of it. And to me personally, it was God's answer to another prayer. And what I learned out there, I learned so well. Of course, I'm not a student of theology, I'm not a minister. So I could be very much better in every way than I am. But I did add two words to my usable vocabulary when we finished that ride. And if that's all I ever did, but those two words alone would be worth a thousand times anything that trip could ever cost me. But those words are, I believe. Now they're small words, but I couldn't use them before that trip. Well, had I told one person I believed in God, to me I would have been a sissy. For since that trip, I've told this story many times. And each time, I've been only too grateful and too glad that I could use those two words and far beyond for what they have meant to me since we came back from that trip. Well, we were on that island 2 days before the natives found us. They took us to their village, which was on another island about 12 miles farther west. Of course, we'd seen the island. We didn't know it was inhabited. When we got there, we found that Captain Rickenbacker's raft with Colonel Adamson, his aide, and Bartek, and Captain Cherry's raft had been picked up at sea the evening before by plane and motor torpedo boats about 30 minutes before a storm struck that area. And none of those men would have ridden out another storm. The following day, the USS Hilo came in and picked us up. We rejoined the others on the island of Funafuti, and that is the southernmost island of the Gilbert Ellis group. his toughness and all of his hardness, I have never seen a man as conscious of God as that same Eddie Rickenbacker. Of course, the rest of us were sent back to the States then for a 30-day leave, just like the active duty.
Thank you. fictitious meaning of what he is doing is right in the sight of the Almighty. Now, that can't be your own opinion. I want some people to say, well, this is my opinion about religion. Well, that isn't the thing. It's what God's opinion about religion is about. Now, somehow I lost his first. And it was kind of about when he got the first copy of him. It was all about it. And this note said, I pray God what I should do about your birth. And God said you may keep the money, but send back the birth. Now, I'm a little bit suspicious of that kind of a prayer, aren't they? But there are quite a few people who conduct their religious life in the same manner. I know if my tape recording is getting close to the end here, so I better get my own due pretty soon. What I've been saying to you this evening is this, man, we make this journey, but one, it can be a lot of fun. I think God intends us to enjoy this world. The Bible says God gave us simply all things to enjoy. I don't think religion is intended to make people miserable. I don't think the purpose of religion is to make you miserable in the sense that when you are truly religious, that you are uncomfortable and happy. I think that people who are truly religious are the most happy people on the face of the earth. They enjoy everything. A good day. A visit with a friend. A walk on the top. The Bible says, I think they enjoy everything if they have true religious faith. You know, lots of religious leaders have stories of saying, they used to make people miserable. And then they were miserable, then they were religious. I think when Jesus was on the earth, those that walked with him found his life was infinitely more interesting and lots more fun when they were him. Well, that didn't mean they didn't suffer. So that they didn't have a disappointment. So they didn't have losses. Or things sometimes were bad. But as God put all things work together for good to them that love the Lord, somehow a person has the right trust when he has sufficient faith and trust in God in his being. Those who wish to stipulate, have your help. I'm talking to you personally. I want you to search your own soul. You take care of yourself physically. You get reasonable rest. You have enough sense to go ahead. You turn out the light when you're chosen. Simple. We did that for two children. We got food for ourselves when we get old. Yeah, we can run along with Frank and Miguel. Nice one on summer day. Wonderful day. Why do the kids run playing? And the minister has to come to the door and he can't wait for the boy playing with Miguel. He said, my boy is your mother home. And the boy says, what do you think?
Do you want to do this? Do you want to do that? First, you want to do it all.
see who's standing